people talk about realism anti-realism as they were black and white or all nothing for me. It's never that way. I don't know anybody that is a complete, any serious philosopher is a complete realist or complete anti-realist. If you take Berkeley, that's an interesting case, right? The prototype of the anti-realist is certainly anti-realist about matter, but it's a super realist about the mind, especially God's mind. So when you talk about realism and anti-realism, the question is that people, philosophers, are located in an interval between a hypothetical integral realism and integral and anti-realism, but these are just limits. I don't think they really exist. And finally, I think that case by case, one has to look at problems and define what forms of realism, if any, fits the issue. And this is cannot be decided, you know, within a priori, I'm a realist or an anti-realist attitude. Okay, so this is very general and obvious. So I will talk about mostly about ontological realism, even if I would say something also about epistemology and semantics. But the idea is that simply things of a certain sort are real, and then this can be different sorts, can be concrete and abstract properties, events, and so are they real or not? That's the issue. With the so there are two different issues about ontological realism. The first one is existence. Do atoms or witches really exist? But also there's another form that is a little more complicated. This is about independence. So everyone thinks that in some sense colors exist. But the point is, do they exist also independently from us, besides the fact that they exist in our mind? So these are two different questions. And the other one is that's epistemic realism. So there might be facts that are in principle unknowable. And that's a particularly important here. The discussion of the 1980s and 90s about internal realism and so on. And the last one is semantic realism, the meaning of a sentence is given, that's Dammett's famous definition, the meaning of a sentence is given by the conditions under which it is true, and this requires the reality of the entities to which the terms of that sentence refer. I told you that I will mostly be concentrated on that, I will say something about this also. Now, there are many debates about realism. The one I will be concentrated on is the relationship or the opposition between common sense realism and scientific realism, where common sense realism is the idea that only the things that we can experience through the senses or through extensions of the senses, like a telescope, are real. So experience is the basis here. And the other one is scientific realism. And this is, in principle, the idea that the world contains the entities, properties, events that are, in principle, describable by science. That's scientific realism. And note that if you take these in the radical forms, they are alternative. So if you think that there are only these or only these, they are alternative. And actually, they are taken generally as alternative. That's my point. So because this can be really solely about common sense features of the world, and the other one can be realist about only the scientific features of the world. Okay, I will first investigate both attitudes, so common sense realist attitude and scientific realist attitude, and then I will say where the supposed conflict is. I don't think it's a real one. Okay, this is a list of people that are, in some sense, common sense realists. Most, not all, but most of the Aristotelian tradition, and then Reid, James, Duhem, G. Moore, Strawson, Austin, and in some ways that had been too qualified, Husserl, Bergson, and Wittgenstein also. All these people took reality more or less coincide with what the senses and experience show us. I reconstructed the tenets of common sense realism. So the first one is, apart from special cases, perception gives us access to the external world as it really is. Like special cases being, of course, like, there is an optical illusion, or you are drunk, or blah, 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 blah. Or you have color blind on these things. But this gives you the connection with perception is crucial. Second, really the objects have both the primary and secondary qualities we tend to attribute to them. So secondary qualities are real. And then, that's also crucial, middle-sized objects have properties that are not identical to whatever microphysical properties constitute those objects. There is no identity here. And finally, so no description in physical terms of those objects could account for their qualitative, functional, axiological, or aesthetic properties. These are all the tenets of common sense realism. But then this could be made more extreme. In this sense, this I paraphrase is an hypothetical common sense realist. I call hyper common sense realism. So the idea here is that when natural sciences appeal to unobservable entities and properties, they go wildly beyond what perception tells us about the external world when you talk about fields or electrons or black holes. So an anti-realistic attitude should be assumed towards these unobservable entities. Okay? That's the attitude. So it's common sense realism, scientific anti-realism. And I will mention two others that strongly defended this view. The first one is Husserling Crisis, where he writes, Galileo performed a surreptitious substitution of the mathematically substructured world of idealities for the only real world, which is actually given through perception, which is ever experienced and experienceable, our everyday life world. Notice this is the only real world. And so, and this substitution was promptly passed to his successors, the physicists of all succeeding centuries. So with Galileo, something happened that really changed in a bad direction our view of the world, because intellectuals, philosophers, scientists tended to assume that the world is not like we experience them with the senses. And so the only real world for Husserl, the life world, is the world of human experience. And in this world, value and meaning are real. Secondary qualities do belong to the external objects in which we would commonsensically locate them. And the life world is the forgotten meaning fundament of natural science. So this means is that it's a genealogical and conceptual fundament. Okay, we wouldn't have the scientific image of the world without having the common sense view of the world. But that's it's forgotten, because it's not just a genealogical origin. It's also the conceptual root foundation of the scientific view. And that's the conclusion. For him, scientific concepts are probably influenced by Duhem. The scientific and Poincaré, scientific concepts are mere idealizations with practical purposes, such as measurement and prediction, but do not refer to any unobservable reality. Okay, so Husserl is very straightforward about this. Scientific realism is false. Okay, people can say, oh, okay, he wrote 7 years ago, he didn't know much, he knew some mathematics, he didn't know about physics, blah, blah, blah. What about this guy then? That's one of the leading philosophers of science nowadays, Bas van Frassen. He has this view called constructive empiricism. You have to be careful in interpreting empiricism here. Constructive empiricism is set squarely within a common sense realism that was foreign to much of the empiricist tradition. You can remember that Hume, for example, wasn't a realist about the secondary qualities either, or not even about the middle-sized objects outside. I mean, at least there is a lot of debate there. Normally, empiricism is taken as an idealist. Okay? He wants with empiricism, it means something like the Aristotelian view. Our experience through the senses tells us what exists. In this light, the common basis, I assume, is language in which reference is unproblematic to trees and mountains, people and books. Okay? So it takes these terms to middle-sized objects as unproblematically referring to real entities. And then he adds, empirically adequate scientific theories that appeal to unobservable entities, black holes or electrons, may be useful heuristic tools, but not They are not true description of the world, like Husserl. That's what I'm saying. Okay? So both Husserl and Van Frassen are common sense realists and scientific anti-realists. It's an interesting view. But am I very interested in their positive side? I'm a common sense realist, but I think their scientific anti-realism is wrong for several reasons. So let me say why one should be a scientific realist. The first reason comes from Patton, his famous then on miracle arguments. So the argument is this briefly. Starting with the scientific revolution, science has been, natural science has been increasingly more precise. And our predictions are so accurate that we can send people on the moon and we can send satellites to Mars. How could this happen if our theories weren't true, or at least approximately true? They're just, you know, tools with no reference to how the world really is. In that case, if science wouldn't really talk about the world as it is, the success of our theories would be an inexplainable miracle. That's his point. Would be a realist interpretation of this success, the success of modern science, is the only one that does not make it a miracle. Notice the structure of this argument. So the argument is science works too well for not being true. This is an inference to the best explanation, as you can easily. So let's analyze this. It's something like we have competing explanations of the success of science. The most important are an anti-realistic one, so instrumentalistic one, like Husserl and Van Frassen, and the other one is a realist one. So the first one is, yes, certainly science works, but it doesn't really refer to the real world. And the other one says, science works because it refers to the real world. And so the second one is highly preferable for Patton. Now, there are several criticisms of this argument that's very much debated. So, for example, one is that this argument begs the question, because it's an inference to the best explanation, that whose goal is to justify other inferences to the best explanation. So, for example, the idea that our physical theories refer to atoms, and so the idea is we have an argument, to meta-argument, for saying that these theories refer really to real entities, atoms. So it's kind of a meta-inference to the best explanation. So because he talks about all the other inferences to the best explanations common in science. But that's not really a vicious circle, I think, because when we talk about inferences to the best explanation regarding scientific theories, we talk about a causal relationship between the theories and the entities to which the theories refer. And here is just a logical one. At the meta level, we only have a logical argument. The logical argument being that in this way, the success of science is explainable. The other way is just a miracle. So it's not really a vicious circle. There are other couple of more arguments. One is this. This argument is that no anti-realist, no Husserl or Van Frassen would be convinced by this argument, because they would say that, you know, there are competing theories that are predictably equivalent, so why should we take that one is better than the other or more true than the other when they both work? And here the point, of course, is that we should look at the long run. When there are competing theories that are really different in some results, they can be, in the future, there can be experimental approaches that you could use to say which is true and which is only a good approximation, which is more adequate. Okay, so in the future, even theories that now presently look equivalent could be proved to be different. And so one would be the one that we would consider true, only one. And this is an interesting objection that was published in a book 3 or 4 years ago. So Jack Ritchie is an Irish philosopher now in South Africa, wrote this book in which he was inspired by Penelope Maddy. This is a quotation from his book. He says that in general, inferences to the best explanation is an empiricist in the sense that only refers to experience. So he says, that in science, really, no scientist has ever accepted inference to the best explanation do not play a significant role in the scientific method, since without direct experimental corroboration, theoretical entities remain merely hypothetical for many scientists. This is his argument. So, in science, inferences to the best explanations do not play a relevant role. Okay, people only accept the existence of entities we cannot observe with the senses when there are experiments that corroborate their experience, their existence. And so, second step with this objection, philosophers should only use scientifically acceptable methods. So Boyd, for example, says that. And so because this is not a scientific method, cannot be used in science, so cannot be used for the no-miracles argument. So the argument is no inference to best explanation in science, no non-scientific arguments in philosophy, so no argument, the no-miracles argument is not acceptable because it's based on an inference to the best explanation. There's actually, his main argument is this. So he says, and that's actually historically accurate, it was only after, more or less accurate, after that Perrin verified experimentally Einstein's views on Brownian motion, that's so kind of late, that scientists came to accept the existence of atoms. So this is the argument. And this proves that people did accept before the existence of atoms, even if they accepted theories that incorporated the reference to atoms. Those theories were taken for just as instruments. That is point. But doesn't work, I think. It's not convincing. First of all, this is his argument. Well, what is this many? If they are not the vast majority, it doesn't work. Even if a consistent minority used accepted atoms before that, would be still scientists accepting them, and so would be a scientific method. So only the lunatic shouldn't accept it for saying that this is not a scientific argument. And actually, that's what, if a substantial minority accepted the existence of atoms before Perrin experiments, why shouldn't one consider those forms of reasoning as a genuine scientific practice? And actually, this is exactly what happened. These are some scientists that did believe in the existence of atoms long before Perrin's experiment. Moreover, should we say that they weren't scientific in accepting the atoms then? By the way, they were right. So should we say that they were using a method that is not scientific? And of course, Galileo and Newton had already accepted atoms, even if in a different sense, without any empirical proof. For Galileo, they were essential in explaining the changes in matter states, and for Newton, the nature of light, famously. So many people were accepting the existence of atoms before empirical evidence that they exist. One of the reasons why people were so instrumentalist at the end of the 1800 and the beginning of 1900 is also the influence of Mach, that was strongly anti-realist. But I think it was an exception anyway. So in general, inferences to the best explanation are very common in science. If we don't really only think about atomism, but about other examples, we'll see how frequent the use of inferences to the best explanation in science is. As everyone knows, the discovery of Neptune was just an example of that, because its existence was assumed by Adams and Laverrier because it was indispensable to explain some mismatch between Saturn's orbit and the predictions of Newtonian physics, and only the gravitation of another unknown planet could explain that. Everyone was convinced, and astronomers looked for Neptune until they found it. So that's an explanation. Galileo became a Copernican without any proof that Copernicanism was better than true compared with the Ptolemaic system. He had an aesthetic reason at the beginning. It was just simpler. That was his argument. And Darwin, that's a wonderful quotation by Darwin. I cannot believe that a false theory would explain, as it seems to me that the theory of natural selection does explain, the several large classes of facts described in my book. So he said, that's an inference to the best explanation. My theory explains so much that cannot be false. Okay, and then, and this is a quotation, I cannot read it, by Huygens. It's unbelievable. That's really a wonderful 1678 presentation of an inference to the best explanation. And in this way, you can still prove something that is so probable that it's a little short of certainty. This is the case when the consequences of the assumed principles are in perfect accord with the observed phenomena, especially when these verifications are very numerous. But above all, when one employs the hypothesis to predict new phenomena, he finds his expectations realized. So this is exactly, in his famous book on light, is a great presentation of an inference to the best explanation. So, and finally, and that's a metaphilosophical argument, why should philosophers agree with Ritchie and Dick Boyd that philosophy should only subscribe to the idea that we should use only scientifically common methods or acceptable methods? I don't find this idea convincing at all. I don't see why. If not, the only justification comes from an ideological approach to what science is. So, summary on this. Ritchie's attack on the non-miracles argument is not effective. And so, if one accepts that argument, the miracle, non-miracles argument, scientific realism is justified. Now, I believe that this is correct, but there is also another reason nowadays for being a realist. That's the fortune of a new form of realism, structural realism, that you may have heard of. So the idea is strongly anti-Leibnizian. Our best theories do not describe the intrinsic nature of the unobservable phenomena to which they refer, but rather their structure. So the relations these phenomena enter into, and there are two interesting interpretations. The first one is epistemic. So we only know the relations between atoms, for example, not their intrinsic nature. But there is another that's even more striking. There are no unobservable objects, but only structural features. So only relations, not entities, that are the bearer of those, or the relator of these relations. So this is strongly anti-Leibnizian. Anyway, these are forms of realism that are available now. And between this form of realism and the more traditional ones, the more traditional scientific realism, I would say the vast majority of philosophers of science nowadays are realist, and with a reason. Okay, now, the problem is that, like with Husserl, also in this case, I think very frequently people take a correct thesis that one has to be a scientific realist and make it extreme. So they make it the idea, they conclude by saying that one should accept the idea that only science tells us what really exists, and perhaps only physics. So this is called strict naturalism or scientific naturalism, and has three tenets, this view. So the first one is an ontological tenet. Reality consists of nothing more than the entities to which the successful explanations of the natural sciences commit us. This, I think, is very common, especially in the US. A little less in Europe, but even in Europe, this is defended by many people, these three views. The second is an epistemological tenet. So for example, Papineau, in his what he writes on naturalism in a Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, defends this idea. The epistemological tenet is that scientific inquiry is our only genuine source of knowledge. Any other potential source of knowledge either is reducible to scientific knowledge or is just illegitimate. Okay? So a priori knowledge, phenomenological, logical knowledge, introspection, and whatever else you want to say. Either they are reducible in principle to scientific knowledge or they don't produce any knowledge at all. And the third one, philosophy must be continuous with science as to its contents, methods, and purposes. These principles. A couple of examples, one, the most famous one. So this is a quotation by Quine. Nothing happens in the world, not the flutter of an eyelid, not the flicker of a thought, without some redistribution of microphysical states. And then he says, full coverage in this sense is the very business of physics and only of physics. And that's a crucial one. And because he comes out with his famous ontological criterion, by which we are committed to the existence of what physics tells us, but nothing else. Only physics tell us what exists. So just because everything is composed of microphysical states, this means that only physics can explain everything. Of course, as you know, he has a problem with abstract entities. He's an ortocollo Platonist in mathematics, as to mathematics. But then he forgets this, and he writes that, you know. And many of these philosophers, the naturalist, extreme naturalist philosophers, share this attitude. They are strictly physicalist about ontology, but then they accept the existence of abstract entities. That's kind of funny, I think. But even more interesting is Sellars here. First of all, it's interesting because Sellars defends a view that is opposite to what Husserl and Van Frassen believe in. He was strongly influenced by through this teacher, Marvin Faber, at the University of New York at Buffalo, where he studied. He was very familiar with Husserl and very influenced by Husserl's view of the relationship between the manifest and the scientific image. This is what he says. He writes about this, his teacher that was a student of Husserl. His combination of utter respect for the structure of Husserl's thought with the equally firm conviction that this structure could be given a naturalistic interpretation was undoubtedly a key influence on my own subsequent philosophical strategy. Because the point with Sellars, as you certainly know, that he thinks, like Husserl, that there is this genesis of the scientific image from the manifest image, but differently from Husserl, he believes that manifest image really substitutes the the manifest image about, you know, in telling us how the world is really structured. He famously writes, "Speaking as a philosopher, not a regular human being, no. As a philosopher, philosophers say strange things. I'm quite prepared to say that the common sense world of physical objects in space and time is unreal. That is, that there are no such things." Okay? It seems to be talking about Kant's noumena here, you know, because noumena are outside space and time. But of course, he's talking about physical entities in which, you know, space and time have a different interpretation, but, you know, common sense, space and time. And then famously, that's probably you know already, or put it less paradoxically, that in the dimension of describing and explaining the world, science is the measurable thing, so what is that it is, and of what is not that it is not. So this is the Protagorean slogan, interpreted in a scientific way. Notice, there are no objects. They are not real. Remember what Van Frassen said, right? I believe in mountains and books. Sellars does not. Okay? There are only atoms and forces, whatever microphysics commits us to. I think this view that's common generates a problem, famous problem, that was called the placement problem by Hugh Price, has been recently called that way, and this is the idea. Which we think about the feature of the common sense view of the world that do not fit into the scientific view, they immediately become problematic. This is a simple list example. So free will, there are many people nowadays that believe that free will is just an illusion, many more than in the past, because it doesn't fit. If you take free will seriously, even in a compatible sense, it's not compatible with what science tells us about the world. If you want, I can explain why it's not. Even compatibilism doesn't work well there, according to them. Moral and normative phenomena, there is no space for normativity there. Self-consciousness, phenomenological properties, collective intentionality, that's a notion that unexplainable by using scientific, only physical concepts. That's an example that comes from Barry Smith, the Barry Smith in Buffalo. As you know, there are different conditions. There is no necessary condition for being a philosopher, but a sufficient condition is being called Barry Smith. And so he told me about financial debts. How can you explain this notion by only using, you know, naturalistic terms? Or mathematical truths, as I told you. Now, the attempts to treat mathematics only using physicalistic dictionary have very bizarre results, like with, as you know, Hartree Field, that believes is a fictionalist about mathematics. So for him, 2 plus 2 is 4 is as false as Oliver Twist was born in London. It's false. So that's the result. If you're a physicalist, a consistent physicalist, you cannot accept the idea that there are mathematical truths. And that's the idea. You have to explain this. Either you explain all these things with the naturalistic vocabulary, or you explain them away. You eliminate them. That's the agenda of these philosophers. Read the word Searle right here. This is what he calls the overriding question in contemporary philosophy. How can we square a conception of ourselves as mindful, meaning-creating, free, rational, etc. agents with a universe that consists entirely of mindless, meaningless, unfree, non-rational, brute physical particles? And he's, you know, he's disappointed because these attempts don't work. I think this looks, to me at least, as a reduction of the idea that there are only, that the universe consists entirely of this. The fact that you cannot really explain all this. And on this, I much more agree with this quotation. The flood of projects that attempt to fit mental causation or mental ontology into a naturalistic picture of the world strike me as having more in common with political religious ideology than with a philosophy that maintains perspective on the difference between what is known and what is speculated. That's, again, is Tyler Birch. And I think that's a very good way of, I would call it a misplacement problem, because the idea of, you know, placing free will or moral responsibility or financial debts or collective intentionality in the world in a way that these phenomena are entirely explained by the physical world is just misconceived. Okay, so let me give my own solution or attempt to where we should go. So liberal naturalism intended as the best form of pluralistic realism. There are three revised tenets. The first one is a liberalized ontological tenet. Some real entities exist that are irreducible but not incompatible with the entities that are part of the coverage domain of a science-based ontology. They're irreducible but not incompatible. Second, that there is a liberalized epistemological tenet. Some legitimate forms of understanding, like a priori or introspection, are neither reducible to scientific understanding nor incompatible with it. And finally, there are cases in which philosophy is not continuous with science for content, method, and purpose, even in some cases it is, I think. There are, for example, I'm interested in the free will issue. The free will issue doesn't exist as such. There are many different issues there. And some are really, there is continuity, in some cases there is continuity between science and philosophy. But in others, there is not. So it depends on the cases. So, but not necessarily philosophy is continuous to science, and it's a mistake to think it is. So let me give you now a metaphysical remark here. I think that, take for example, micro objects. I think micro objects, common sense objects, supervene on the scientific world. But as you know, that's a case of global supervenience because of the externalist considerations. But the notion of global supervenience is a covariation notion, and it says that it's supervenient entities depend for their existence on the subvenient entities, but they are not identical to them. That's the whole point of the supervenient. When it was introduced first by Moore and then by Davidson, the idea was exactly this, to have a form of mild naturalism that wasn't reductionism. And so this is connected. Also, semantic externalism, I think, here helps in addressing the issue of common sense objects. When we refer to the chair, for example, I think what counts is our causal connection with chairs. It's not the description of the chair that fits, but it's the causal connection between the term and the entity in the world. And so when we refer to a chair, we refer to a solid object. This solid object, we know, is composed by physical entities. This is the famous case set, this understanding that comes out of Eddington's famous statement that there are two tables here. One is a solid entity. It does not exist. And the other one is an incredible number of atoms that are very small percentage of this part of the world, because mostly it is empty. So Eddington says there are two tables. One is illusionary and it's solid. The other one is not solid. It's mostly empty and it's the only real one. The problem is that he confuses here the microscopic object to which our world refers, that the concept of table refers to the solid microscopic object, and then we know that the common sense object is composed of physical entities that, you know, as such, are part of a space that is mostly empty. But the table is only at the microscopic level. Some last remarks. That's one thing that people tend to, these harsh naturalists tend to be confused about. I don't think there is one ontology, one methodology. There is an interesting article by the crazy philosopher, good friend of mine, but still, I should say it's crazy, John Dupre. It's the miracle of monism. He says monism itself is a miracle, because if it was true, because there are so many differences between just looking at the sciences, the ontology of the sciences, the ontology of microphysics or biology, or not without, not even mentioning the social sciences, but even between microphysics and macrophysics, there are incredible differences. So there is no one ontology, and even more, there is no one methodology of science. When people say that philosophy should be continuous with science for its methodology, what is the methodology of science? The methodology. There is not such a thing. Also, I think that there are excellent reasons for using a liberalized ontological criterion. I think the way in which Quine interprets the Quine pattern ontological criterion is too narrow. He says we are committed to accept the existence of the entities that are part of the ontology of our best theories, whereas for him the best theories are physical theories. Pattern itself is much more, you know, the other father of this criterion, is much more open-minded. So there are many ways, many theories that work well for us. Certainly, in order to explain why we are here today, we wouldn't use physics or biology. The best theory to explain why we are here nowadays is a theory full of intentional and normative terms. We have all reasons to accept these theories as working well for us. And so, with another inference to the best explanation, we would think that the entities postulated by these theories, common sense theories, exist really, including agents, free and rational agents. Okay, you know probably Dowell Davidson anomalous monism. That was one of the first example of a liberalized naturalist, but with a defect. As you know, Davidson, each mental event supervenes on physical events in this way, right? There is no identity between the event, I believe that Kathmandu is the capital of Nepal, and some neurological event. That's, the correspondence is open, indefinitely open. It could even be, for Davidson, I think he's right, that a mechanical mind one day will have that belief. So there is no correspondence property to property, type to type. It's only token, but here it's a it's supervenient, so one can have many realizations, right? That's the idea. Then when we use causation, what happens? For example, I want to do something, I do something. That's a physical action, right? So there are two explanations here. One is physical, the other one is intentional. Two causal explanations. Now the problem, the problem is that Davidson accepts a tenet that I think is wrong. He thinks that any form of causation is covered by a physical law. So even if we don't know, if I say X wants to do F, okay, or wants to do with Z, okay, that's an action. This can be reformulated in a physical way where the causation exemplifies a physical law. So he said this new human view, every causal relation supervenes on a physical law, and that's very strong. I don't see why it should be that way. And this is the final result, is that the mind, the mental states are totally causally inefficacious. The Davidsonian mind is epiphenomenal, because here the whole work is done by the physical properties. The mental properties do not add anything, because the real causal relation is the one that exemplify physical law. So the physical properties are the causally efficacious properties. So I think Davidson was, you know, had this very good idea of being anti-reductionist about the type-type relation between the mind and the body. And he was had this a good idea that there are different causal explanations of phenomena. But then he had this reductive ontological idea that all causal explanations are reducible to physical. Also, all causal relations are reducible to physical relations that exemplify physical laws. And that, I think, is ungrounded and gives this incredible problem that the mind is epiphenomenal. So a much better way is to accept the idea that there are different forms of causation in the world, depending on what interest we have in asking what happened. So, for example, think about this. And all these explanations are legitimate depending on what we are talking about. So, for example, let's assume that someone has a stroke. We can ask, why did he have a stroke? And so one answer is, you know, physiological answer is, you know, there was an obstruction of his blood circulation and blah, blah, blah. That's one explanation. But this wouldn't interest, I don't know, the relatives of this person. The relatives would be more interested in saying, oh, he had that because yesterday he ate too many fettuccine. That's what's... And people could be guilty because they didn't stop him from eating many fettuccine, whereas they wouldn't feel guilty of not stopping his clogging. The doctor would say, of course he did have a stroke. His family, 100% of males after 50 had a stroke. That's a good explanation, right? But it depends on what interest you have. Why should there be a priority one of these explanations over the other? So you say, really, it's not clear to me. All these explanations also use terms that generalize to different cases. So saying, you know, that talking about physiological terms, we are referring to a class of physiological events. When I refer to people that, for example, is ate too much, when someone ate too many fettuccines, I'm referring to a different class. I'm generalizing to a different class of events in explaining the causal relation. So really, this priority of physical causation, I think, is one of the most dangerous attitudes of contemporary philosophy. And so finally, I think that we should look for some kind of a reflective equilibrium between the two worldviews. Whereas nowadays, people tend to be imperialistic from the scientific side, and some, for example, the phenomenologists, tend to be imperialistic starting from the common sense side. And I don't like imperialism. Thank you very much. Thank you.